Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, October 22nd, Joe was joined by founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center of Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College, Roger Berkowitz, dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
Mr. Trump, a presidential candidate, was pursued by federal law enforcement and eventually won the election. I do think it's important. This is what I was saying to my screaming at my radio last night as I heard this story coming home. You won! You won! Anyway, the situation has no parallel. It's the starkest example yet of potential ethical conflicts created by installing the president's former lawyers atop of the Justice Department. Mr. Trump submitted complaints through an administrative claim process that often is the precursor of lawsuits. The first claim, lodged in late 2023, seeks damages for a number of purported violations of his rights, including the FBI and special counsel investigation into Russian election tampering and possible connections to the 2016 Trump campaign, according to people familiar with the matter. They spoke on the condition of anonymity because the claim has not been made public. This all from a New York Times report that I am reading this morning by Devlin Barrett and Tyler Pager. Asked about the issue at the White House after an article published, the president said, "I was damaged very greatly, and any money I would get, I would give to charity."
Mm-hmm.
"I'm the one that makes the decision, and that decision would have to go across my desk, and it's awfully strange to make a decision where I'm paying myself. You think?" Lawyers said the nature of the president's legal claim poses undeniable ethics challenges. Bennett Gershman is an ethics professor at Pace University. He took all of this information in. He looked at all of the paperwork in front of him.
And the quote of the day?
"What a travesty," is what he said. "The ethical conflict is just so basic and fundamental, you don't need a law professor to figure this one out." All right, so we begin. Judy Patrick.
Breathtakingly unethical, I would say. And, you know, the bottom line here is it's going to happen no matter what. There's nothing anybody can do about it. And I love the idea that even Donald Trump thinks that, you know, this seems odd to him. If you remember, in many ways, the prosecutions ginned up his campaigns, helped him, if nothing else. And also, he didn't pay his own legal fees. He had committees pay his legal fees, so he wasn't really out any money. If anything, I think he gained from the prosecution. So maybe he should be paying us back. At a time, I would think the Democrats have their fingers crossed, hoping he actually gets paid, because isn't that a wonderful political campaign argument. So nothing you can do. It's a bit of a distraction at this point, but I don't think he really was damaged in any way by these things.
$230 million and said to be going to charity, which and I don't think I'm just saying something that's been proven and reported, which is that the Trump and the Trump brand and their relationship of giving money to charity is quite questionable and has been questioned over many, many years, well before he even entered the political realm. Roger Berkowitz.
You know, and there's an absurdity to this. And yet, as Judy said, Trump recognizes the absurdity. I mean, I agree. And I thought the prosecutions were a mistake because I thought they would help Trump. You know, there's no doubt that being prosecuted by four or five different prosecutors around the country having your homes invaded and such is something that will upset people. And there was, I think, you know, look, he a lot of these things that he was prosecuted for, he did. And so these were discretionary prosecutions. I thought at the time, and I still think, that it was wrong to do them. And I can understand why he has a grievance. And I think we have to understand that he and many people in his orbit do feel that the federal government singled him out and was weaponized against him. And I don't think that's entirely wrong. I think at this point, what he's asking for is ridiculous, and the idea that his loyal minions are going to just give it to him is a joke. And you know, I agree with Joe that he's not a very charitable person. That's been shown over and over again. But we'll see. I think it's a distraction, but I think it's evidence of just a deeper and deeper sense of corruption on which both sides have no trust in the impartiality or goodness or truthfulness of the institutions of our country. And I think it's a travesty, but it's where we're at.
The president seemed to acknowledge that this was odd in the Oval Office last week when he alluded vaguely to the situation while standing next to the FBI Director Kash Patel, Attorney General Pam Bondi, and her deputy Todd Blanche. According to Justice Department regulations, the Deputy Attorney General, in this case, Mr. Blanche, is one of two people eligible to sign off on the settlement. Trump said, quote, "I have a lawsuit that was doing very well, and when I became president, I said, well, I'm sort of suing myself," adding, "it sort of looks bad. I'm suing myself, right? So I don't know, but that was a lawsuit that was very, very strong, very, very powerful." Bob Griffin.
Oh, God, where do I start? You know, even though it's absurd and he will publicly recognize, he being Trump will publicly recognize the oddity of it, it's not going to stop him. I have a personal theory, though, that this is part of a plan that he has, that as he looks at his lists of his Festivus poll of grievances against the country and against the citizens of the country, that this is on it, and he's going to push forward to try to take every cent possible out of the public treasury. And I think, Judy, I thought you were going down a path that I want to take a couple steps down. Is that at the same time he's talking about the $230 million robbery, the state of Texas, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, New York, and several other states are warning its recipients that there will be either a reduction or complete elimination of SNAP benefits. Okay, let's start to frame where this guy is. Okay, at the same time the government is shut down and you're seeing federal workers and their families literally in line for basic necessities like food. This administration is spending $178 million to purchase two luxury jets for the Secretary of Homeland Security. At the same time, women, the WIC program, Women Infant Care Program, which is designed specifically to deal with the most vulnerable of populations, is being decimated. They're ripping down the White House to build a ballroom. We're talking about a government that is.
I believe it's a wedding venue. But go ahead.
Is he getting married again?
No, I think they're going to rent it out.
I'm sorry. Now I get it. I just figured he was due. You know, it's stunning to me that the brazenness of it and the fact that there's still such a large proportion of the country that supports him. You know, Roger, I understand the comment, and I do go back and forth on this idea, and part of me, agrees with Romney's assessment that Biden should have just pardoned Trump as part of the presidency, cleared the deck, sort of similar how Ford did. But at the same time, the findings in these reports were upheld. And what's interesting to me is that the issue of Russia and Russia collusion was actually upheld in a report that came out of the Senate that was published by none other than our current Secretary of State Rubio. My continued and consistent frustration, and one of the reasons why I have dramatically soured on both Biden's presidency, but more importantly on Merrick Garland, is I don't think that he moved quickly enough. So I'm not surprised by this. I also will toss out for the panel to talk about is this also shows you the dysfunction and basic fecklessness of Congress. Okay, they control the purse strings. Okay, yeah. there is no oversight right now, right now, and that's a real problem for the country.
All right, back to our discussion about the $230 million that Donald Trump wants as a result of being put through the process that he was put through. Jay Jockmans.
There's just so much to unpack there. To Bob's point that, all this other stuff is going on, that people who are on SNAP benefits are facing going hungry, that people who have health coverage are going to lose their health coverage because they won't be able to afford it, that all the rest of us, anyone who's buying anything from just about anywhere else in the world other than rather rare these days, made entirely in America products, is paying an extra tax on it because of this president. Just on and on, that there are all these financial issues facing the country, and here the president wants $230 million. Wants a $230 million refund, as Judy pointed out, of something he didn't even pay in the first place. He raised this money from all the people out there, many of whom have since complained that they were put on lists that they didn't intend to be on, that, you know, recurring payments from their credit cards until they discovered it. It's just grifting, just so much of it. But I think the obviousness of this, as the person pointed out, you don't need a law professor to explain the ethical problem here. It's extraordinary. And as the Times pointed out, the maybe one person who might be able to referee this, the ethics of it, has been fired by the same president who now finds himself in this self-made ethical dilemma. But I think the really, really important thing to remember is has been touched on to some degree is that none of this, except the Russia investigation, has been really adjudicated. My editors always reminded me there is no such thing as pleading innocent or being found innocent. You're found not guilty. And Trump has not even been found not guilty. Certainly, he's never going to be found innocent of anything, I don't think. But the documents case. It is not a parallel, as much as he and many of his defenders want to make it, is not a parallel to Biden. He took pains to cover up what he should have just given back, and it could have all gone away. And that's why the Justice Department did a raid on his house, was because he was just digging in and saying, I don't have the documents, and daring them to come and take them. The January 6th case was not adjudicated, and Georgia was not adjudicated. The obstruction, the Russia one, is really interesting because he wants to maintain, and Bill Barr gave him some cover on this. He wants to maintain that he didn't do anything wrong, when in fact as a plain reading of the findings. Showed he obstructed and obstructed and obstructed, and his administration obstructed. This should be, he's bringing up he's acting as if he was found completely innocent of all these things, completely not guilty of all this, when in fact, either he was guilty of some of it or it's never been fully hashed out. And the government should not be in the business of giving a refund on that basis.
But, you know, Joe, it's not a bad strategy if you think about it in terms of by raising sort of these examples of when he was supposedly mistreated and bringing the attention of his base back, he's taking attention away from how bad the economy is. And for any of you who are out there who have gone food shopping lately, you know the prices haven't come down. If any of you follow any of the trade magazines, you know that the holidays are going to be grim when you think about the issues of the federal shutdown, what that's doing to the overall economy, and sort of the whole malaise that I feel is all around us with the economy. Taking attention back and taking attention from those real issues and saying, you know, I've just been treated so badly, you can't believe anything any of them say, may not be the worst strategy. I also wouldn't be at all surprised. Let me toss this little nugget out for, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't continue to make these wild grabs for personal aggrandizement, personal, you know, money for him and his family, because he knows that he's not going to last his term out, and that he'll step back, get a full pardon from Vance, and then he will have achieved everything that he's looking for.
That was Robert Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, October 22nd. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, October 23rd, Joe was joined by partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Henler, and Wall Street investment banker, Mark Whitman.
President Trump's plan to build a White House ballroom has underscored an oft-overlooked aspect of presidential power. No one could stop the president from tearing down much of the East Wing this week. And no one probably ever thought that that was going to be an issue. But here we go. The next stage of the project is also likely to proceed with few restraints. The key panel slated to review the president's construction plan is now stocked with Trump allies ready to approve them. Photos of construction teams knocking down portions of the East Wing first revealed by the Washington Post on Monday, and I read from the Washington Post this morning, have rattled city residents, historians, politicians, and, yes, historic preservationists, many of whom contended that Trump was wrongfully tearing apart the People's House, which is what the White House is referred to, the People's House, to build his long-desired ballroom. It's not his house, it's your house, and he's destroying it. Hillary Clinton, who battled Trump for the presidency in 2016, wrote on social media. Others contend that Trump's shifting projections and promises, such as pledging in July that the ballroom wouldn't interfere, quote unquote, with the White House, that they were separate projects, and that he would have great reverence for the building, and increasing his estimate of cost and how many people will fit in the building, illustrate the need for more transparency. Conservative commentator Byron York said Trump, quote, needs to tell the public now what he's doing with the East Wing of the White House and then tell the people why he didn't tell them before he started to actually do it, which I think is fairly obvious, but yet I understand the point. Rebecca Miller is the executive director of the D.C. Preservation League, a nonprofit that advocates for protecting historic sites in Washington. She said dozens of concerned citizens from the city and around the country have called and emailed her to express outrage. Miller said she has had to explain that the White House, because of the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966, is exempt from the required reviews that other federal agencies must undergo when seeking to alter government property. Our hands are tied, Miller said, adding that normally government officials discuss major projects with preservationists, but not this time. It's very frustrating that there's nothing that the organization can do from a legal or advocacy perspective. This was pointed out in several of the news articles, which I think is interesting. Some of the work that is being done is difficult to see from a public viewpoint. But in the Treasury building, there's some direct lines where you can go and see what they're doing. The Treasury Department on Monday and Tuesday put out messaging to all of their employees: don't you dare take photos of the construction or destruction that is being done at the White House. With that said, there's still a great number of pictures and videos that are out there of the building being, to be friendly, altered. Mark.
You know, Joe, when I first waved my give a meter over this, it didn't have much response. But I thought about it again, and you and the listeners won't be surprised. I actually do have something to say. This whole thing is a primetime example of why folks end up turning to populists who smash not just norms, but laws. You know, the White House, as you said, is exempt from many preservation rules, giving Trump, the presidency, some latitude. But critics rightfully say that he's pushing a vanity project. It's wrapped in half-truths, lies, and it'll end up in ballooning costs. My under-over for the final cost, if we ever get a true accounting, is $750 million. Mark that down. But there's a reason he's bypassing these laws. It's to get something done. The White House is a living building that's arguably not fit for purpose, and the guy in charge of the place wants to do something different with it. Of course, the liberal response is pretty emotional and not very effectual. If you heard Anderson Cooper last night, I thought the guy was going to – I actually happened to listen to his opening. I listened to it on radio, but I thought he might cry.
I agree. I heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he sounded like he was about to lose it.
Right. And if you listen to – read the Washington Post article that you gave to us today, the myriad of – committees and approvals and laws, even for the president to alter the White House, was to me absolutely staggering. And it's emblematic of why in this country we can't get nice things. I'm not justifying what Trump's doing, but it's emblematic of the problem. You know, politicians from New York City to Albany worry about how do we solve the housing crisis centered particularly in New York City? What could we ever do to revitalize municipalities up and down the Hudson River? Oh, I don't know. How about a bullet train, which would solve all those problems and be financially compelling? But without central planning in this country, like they have in, say, China, where they get things like that done, we can never have a project that would require cutting through so much red tape, so much parochialism, and so much political short-sightedness. So this whole thing is just emblematic of why the only politician who can really get stuff done is one who's hyperactive and willing to act illegally, and basically a pox on both of our or all of our houses for this whole thing.
Yeah, so. I was just going to say I had a similar reaction at first. I was like, okay, I'm not surprised that Trump wants to upgrade a building. Like, that's not surprising to
He's
me.
He's got a drive through.
Exactly, but when the images came out, the optics were disgusting to me because we're in the middle of a shutdown. I'm seeing on one station people, federal workers lined up in D.C. at food banks to get food, and then we have the president of the United States renovating. You know, I think the optics and the timing, if anything, is terrible when you know there's millions of people not being paid and wondering whether or not they're going to get paid on November 1st. And then the second thing, and then I'll end, is when he said, oh, we're paying with private donations. That's when I started doing a little digging. Because I was like, wait, is this East Wing going to look like a hockey arena? It's going to have, like, Amazon. And, like, I was like, what does this look like? How do we do this? But there is a legal, since it's through the National Park Services, they can get private donations, apparently, if it's only for a specific purpose. But I had to look into that, too, because I was, like, worried.
Well, we had the Musk dealership on the Juan when, remember that?
Yes,
when
we.
They had all, I mean, yeah. I, so I don't
it feels,
know.
It feels so long ago. We're like, it was a few months ago.
I know. It was a long time ago.
The $230 million he wants from the Justice Department can then be just transferred over to the building department.
Well.
No, because he's asked for that to go to his personal reimbursement.
That's his personal reimbursement.
So he would have donate. To make a donation.
He said he might.
Although.
He might make, oh, well.
Well, there's, yeah, well, so, you know, what's interesting is, while I agree with you on sort of there are often too many laws and restrictions, things like that, I'm often frustrated reading about that. In D.C. and for the mall and for the president, there's always been just a lot of agreements. It hasn't been a whole set of very obstructionist laws. Presidents have almost always been allowed to do small changes to the White House, and then big changes went through the Committee for the Preservation of the White House, as they would for any historic building, right? So what Trump did is he put two people onto that committee, which is a two-person committee, as I understand it, or there's two people who do the final review or something. It's been reported differently. But he started by saying, this is going to be a cheap project that won't actually impact the White House. All we're doing is upgrading the ballroom. Now, the East Wing ballroom is going to be larger than the rest of the White House. It's going to be, there's photos now of what he has proposed. It's completely lined in gold. And in fact, it turns out to be a mirror of a ballroom he has in Mar-a-Lago, which is where he holds his $1 million a plate fundraisers, right? So, I mean, this is a vanity project. This is not a renewal of a part of a building that was falling over. This is not, we had a small room that wasn't functioning. If you look at some of the history of what's been in the East Wing, you know, it was primarily used for small receptions of great import, right? Now it's going to be too big for that. Right. You're not going to bring in 20 people to talk about some important international issue and host them in a room that holds 1,000 people who, you know, can go to a party. I mean, it's completely different. And, you know, Alan Chartok used to, every time Trump's name came up, say, lying, lying, liar. And I was like, well, you know, he's right. Okay, Trump said about this project on the air, on the record, in front of cameras, this project will not require any real damage to the White House. It will not have a high cost. It will not be anything other than a small renovation, like when I paved over the Rose Garden. So I'm sorry, it's not my liberalism that's being offended here. It's my belief that there's got to be some decency somewhere in the federal government. And almost every other story we're going to discuss today is going to be exactly that same response, that this whole movement that says what we're after is just to sort of remove the federal government, make it so that it's small enough that it can fit in the a bathtub and drown, famous quote, right, is doing it by giving more and more power to the federal government to do whatever the heck they want all over the country, all over the world. And if I sound outraged by this, it's because I've become outraged by this. And, you know, I've mentioned this before. I'll stop real fast, Jen. I'll take it up again after that.
We don't even have time for you to stop real fast. We'll take a break. We'll be back, and we'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we are talking about the construction project at the White House. We will go with those words. And the basically, as the east wing of the White House is being torn down. Two interesting things, I thought. First of all, one of the items in the east wing of the White House is the Nixon bowling alley. So that's that is something. Now, Truman had the first bowling alley, but that was in the west wing. And then it was moved for Nixon to go in the east wing, mm-hmm. and is used by, you know, whoever, I guess, private, but it would all be private, obviously, of who could be in there. The other thing that's in the east wing, the big thing that's in the east wing, besides the current ballroom, is the office of Melania Trump, the first lady. So I think that's interesting as well.
We also have the JFK frolicking swimming pool, which was covered over to build the press conference room.
That's correct. Yes. So
well, they don't need a press conference room anymore.
No, they don't.
Yes. So so now, Jim, I had to interrupt you, and I hope you will take this in the spirit of which I mean it, which is I got you in mid-rant. Yes. So I want you to continue.
So let me finish the rant. Right. So here's the thing, right? I mean, even if you wanted to go with the fact that, theoretically, the president is supposed to ask a particular board for permission. He stacked the board. The board was planned to approve it. This coming week, I think it was, he's already tearing it down. He's not even waiting for his own appointed board to make the decision saying it's okay. I mean, it's just to me mind-boggling. And it's the same thing, you know, send in the troops, then you get a restraining order, then you get an appeal, then you get an appeal on the appeal, then maybe eventually it gets to the Supreme Court, which only rules on that one particular city or one particular place. And it goes on, you know, and it all is, we have a government where, so here, I'll tell you a story. I was sitting with one of the generals who I used to hang around with, who had been one of the first people, retired generals, who used to be one of the first people into Russia when we sort of had detente and were starting to make joint plans with them and we were friends. And he said, you know, the thing that the Russians admired most about our form of government is that no one person could come in and change everything. And our general said, you know, the one thing we admire about your form of government is you can get things done. And the problem is there's no middle. But this, the speed that this is being done, the lack of even respect for their own things, and the fact that this is all being done in the name of, quote, smaller government, right? So in the name of smaller government, I'm sending National Guard troops into your city, right? I mean, this is just getting to me. And, you know, my wife is, I've mentioned on the show before, quite progressive, left wing, has been for years, you know, I've been, no, it's okay. We have a system that has checks and balances. They're all gone, right? And we've learned what it's like to have a dictator and to have somebody who can make whatever decisions they want and make them come true. And then, like Joe was saying, you know, you're not allowed to take pictures, right? Why? This is reality happening. We just don't want anyone to know what the reality is. It was the same thing with some of the targeting of. I'm sorry. I'll stop.
Are you ranted out?
No, but we have four other stories that I get to rant on.
Get Teresa in here and let them have a rant off.
You know, it's really funny. I do say it's true. I sit here with Teresa, and I can't believe she's going on and on and on like this. But today, I just
it's that.
Well, may
and I woke up in a good mood.
At your own risk. Go ahead.
By the way, the 1,000-seat ballroom, which has more, means your suggestion that they can't do anything unless there's 1,000 people. You know, the local Holiday Inn takes care of that by putting up in dividers, and you can have several small events. But that aside, Listen, this is literally a bully in a china shop. Everything that you guys have said, I agree with in terms of the obnoxiousness and the presumptuousness of Trump doing it and asking for permission later or being asked to uphold questions later. I was gonna say much of what you guys said. I don't want to repeat it, but it's certainly just the latest in a long list. And at some point, somebody has got to speak up who he can listen to and can help sway his base, because his base is cheering him along.
That was Ira Fussfeld on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, October 23rd. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, October 24th, Joe was joined by Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, and Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont.
President Trump ratcheted America's economic war with Russia to a higher level on Wednesday by moving to cut off its two largest oil companies from the global financial system, signaling a new willingness by the U.S. to cripple the U.S. energy sector despite the risk of higher oil prices. The decision to impose sanctions went beyond previous efforts to hamper Russia's economy and demonstrate the extent of Mr. Trump's frustration with Russian President Vladimir Putin. After months of failed talks to end the war in Ukraine, although the sanctions hit just two companies, they have the potential, if strictly enforced, to strike a major blow to the Russian economy by sapping it of energy revenues. This reporting from the New York Times and Alan Rappaport. The move represents a striking shift in strategy from Mr. Trump, who has largely refrained from punishing Russia and has questioned the effectiveness of sanctions after the Biden administration imposed sanctions on about 5,000 Russian targets from 2022 to 2024. Mr. Trump, until this week, had imposed none. What do we make of this, Bill?
I mean, it seems like directionally, you sort of wish this had happened sooner, because this is, oil is the source of cash. Like, it's this huge source of money for the Russian economy. It's where Putin has been getting money to finance his war. It's also, like, it's preventing the Russian economy from tanking. And up until now, presidents and other, President Biden and other world leaders have shied away from going after this because they were worried about the blowback on their own economies. If there's a shortage of oil, it's going to lead to higher fuel prices, higher heating costs, and general inflation in their own countries. That was a pretty explicit decision that the Biden administration made. We're going to sanction Russia, but we're not going to cut off their oil completely. This doesn't cut off anything completely, but the idea that you're going harder after their oil seems like it's a it seems like the kind of move that a lot of people would have applauded under a previous administration. And so I think it'll probably be well received now.
Although I think it's more symbolic than anything else. I mean, is this really going to affect Russia and Putin? The U.S. gets almost no oil from Russia right now anyway. So Russia's top oil customers are China and India. And China has an insatiable and growing need for oil. And they have shown themselves willing to be political allies with Russia. And so I don't know their ability to absorb whatever losses Russia may incur from these sanctions, but I think the losses will be minimal. I think that China can help make up whatever gap there will be. And even if that's not true, the third point here is that Putin has shown himself very willing and very resilient in terms of taking these kind of risks. And so I don't think it's going to deter Russia in the short term at all.
I agree. And my first point on my notes here, Malia, was India and China are the key here, right? Will the Trump administration understand fully? I'm sure they understand, but will they understand fully that the puzzle piece requires that there be secondary sanctions on the China and Indias of the world? Also, Bill, to get to your point about, you know, Biden tried the sanctions, and will the Trump administration fully understand what the press is calling the shadow fleet, right? This ability that Russia has and Putin has to circumvent sanctions by having tankers and trucks that don't bear the flag of Russia still delivering across lines. So I think there are lots of pieces to this. Let's talk a little bit about the numbers, right? The gas oil industry revenue accounts for 25% of the Russian federal budget. 25% of the Russian federal budget. I think Malia's right. I don't think it's going to make that much of a difference. But it didn't surprise me that Putin says this is going to hurt a little bit. If it's 25% of the Russian federal budget, that's significant. What are we talking about? $600 million a day of oil passes through Russia to other countries. That's $600 million is a significant amount of money. These two oil firms account for 3.1 million barrels of crude oil a day. They're about 100 million barrels. So it's 3.1% of the world's appetite for oil. You know, that's fairly significant. I do think, like Bill, I think you're right. I think it was a little late in coming. And the other piece that I'll throw out on the table before I yield the floor is if I'm one of Trump's advisors, I say these sanctions are important. You've got to think about secondary sanctions. You also have to couple this with military aid to Ukraine, because sanctions alone are not going to make the difference in moving the needle on this particular war. Tomahawks should be back on the table, and if you couple sanctions with military aid, you might make some movement on stopping Putin. But until you do the second part, it's not going to happen.
It is striking. Putin, like, it's hard to keep track of these events, but there was a particularly awful strike on Ukraine, which hit a kindergarten and, you know, killed a lot of civilians.
Right.
That came after President Trump issued some kind of warning. So you wonder if there's going to be something now. You know, like, he announces sanctions,
right.
Putin orders another strike. Putin does seem completely immune to the threats that the style of negotiation that President Trump engages in. And if anything, doubles down when he feels like the president is trying to push him around. So I'm not pretending that this will be an effective strategy. I feel like it might have been more effective if it had been implemented in cooperation with the rest of the world, with as much as possible of cooperation from China and India at the beginning of the war rather than, you know, several years into it.
So, can I go?
Go ahead.
Okay. So, I think it's fascinating to think about what's happened over what, Bill, Joe, Malia, 10 days total we've gotten to this point. So,
the back and forth.
The back and forth, right. So, if you just take that slice of temporal of time, you know, Trump is this is the sequence of events. Trump considers long-range missiles for Ukraine. He calls Putin. He retracts the offer after the call for Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. He tells Zelensky he may have to cede the land already occupied by Russia. Trump sets up a summit in Hungary. It's ironic that it's in Hungary, but we'll let that slide. They get wind, right, that Putin won't budge. The White House gets wind that Putin's not going to budge in that summit. So Trump cancels the summit. Moscow is taken by surprise. Sanctions is the response for that. I do think this is an escalation, a significant escalation in Trump's attempt to prevent further war. I think he's emboldened by Gaza. I think this is an escalation, but as I said before, I think it needs more pieces.
There's so many things to hook into here. I don't think Trump really cares about peace all that much in Ukraine. I think he's trying to go hand to hand. It's kind of like, you know, an arm wrestling match with Putin, and he's just trying all these different ways to show that he's Putin's equal. Because I think that's the person. Either Putin or Xi Jinping of China. Those are the world leaders that he really admires in many ways. And these sanctions, even if they did work, they're not going to. Economic sanctions are such sort of brutish and imprecise tools for accomplishing specific goals. So, I mean, to stop a war, it's always a complex matter, right? But cutting off a little bit of the money stream to the guy who has been prosecuting this war for years because he thinks it's one of his core national security interests isn't really, it's hard to see how that substantially contributes to bringing peace in Ukraine.
You're the international affairs expert in the room today, so I'm going to ask you this question because this morning, no, I don't. I think it's a bit of a softball, right? I think it's a bit of a softball. But this morning, I read that Modi, the leader of India, said we will ramp down our use of Russian oil. Do we think that's honest? And B, if it is a ramp down, does that make Putin take a step closer to the negotiating table?
I think it makes Putin take a step closer to China.
You think China takes up all of the?
I'm not sure if they do. They have the need. I mean, they have almost no domestic oil production themselves. So this is why China has been focusing so much on building a blue water navy. A navy that's capable of operating around the world offshore. This is why they have invested billions of dollars in ports around the world. They've transformed the port of Karachi, for example, and they're dotted around the world, and it's largely along the oil import lanes to China. So I don't know what kind of pipelines or whatever they have to Russia in particular, but I think that the demand is there. I'm not sure if China's leadership wants to fill all that demand now with Russia, but certainly over decades, there hasn't been a lot of love lost between China and Russia. But I think even though ideologically they have their differences, they are closer now than they have been in a generation. Just that the two leaders have similar styles, they have similar interests, and they've been able to support each other and each other's countries without much strategic risk.
Putin is increasingly isolated from the Western world, and so China has been kind of a fallback for him.
And, right, and part of their goal is they want to be more, they want to be seen more, and not just seen, but actually want to be more active global leaders in a way. And so it burnishes their sort of internationalist credentials as well.
Yeah, listen to this. I thought this was super interesting data. So Trump announces the sanctions yesterday. No, a couple days ago, right? Trump announces the sanctions, and it triggered a 5% increase in oil prices. That compares to a 1.6% increase in oil prices when Great Britain announced a few days before Trump did that they were going to sanction Russia too. So it also sort of says something about American production. American usage of oil. It's 20% of the world's oil is used by the United States every year. Every day. But it also says something about the inflated. I think if you're Trump, you're feeling bold and confident that you, as opposed to Europe, you can make a difference if oil prices go up, 300% compared to the UK, also a powerful country, can't get the needle to move.
I guess I'm not being an expert on international oil markets. I suspect a part of what's going on there is that
we'll get with it.
Part of what's going on there is that the markets are looking. They say Great Britain, they're like, that's interesting. That's a sign of something going on. And then when the U.S. jumps in, they're like, oh, this is real.
Yeah.
Like, apart from the relative consumption figures, they're recognizing, oh, this is like a coordinated effort. They've been talking to each other, and other countries are going to get on board. They're sort of seeing the scope of it in a way that any one country making an announcement wouldn't have swung. It's just a suspicion.
Do you think there are any domestic political interests here in the United States that really are impacted by this, or is it Trump trying to flex his international muscles?
I think it's Trump trying to flex his international muscles because Bill, I think it was Bill who said we get none, or Malia, you said none of our oil imports from Russia to begin with.
Very, very little.
Yeah,
but if it raises oil prices, it's a negative thing politically.
Well, that's what's so interesting about what happened. So Biden tries the sanctions 10 days before he's leaving office, right? And the reason he waited so long to sanction Russian oil, he did the same thing. He picked two major companies and he sanctioned those two major companies. The reason he waited so long is because he was so burned with the inflation. You said this, Bill. He was so burned with inflation that he had no appetite a year before to raise prices in an environment in which people are paying $8 or $10 for eggs.
Well, I think Trump has a different relationship with Saudi Arabia, for one, than Biden did, and is also much more willing to turn up domestic oil production.
True.
So he probably, to the extent that he and his team have considered that there may be a rise in oil prices, they probably feel like that's a problem they can solve pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think that's true. But it's also interesting the data that Joe read before this segment and the increase in inflation that I think probably overall, I think probably took them by surprise.
Let's see. I think we have a couple of letters here, and I would like to get to those. Excuse me. Ray says, I agree that tomahawks should be part of the equation. Stop making Ukraine fight with one arm tied behind their back and stop waffling with the other. Then we got this from Ellen, who says, if you listen to Planet Money on Russia's shadow fleet, these sanctions will not have the impact that we would like. The oil price will rise, but Russia will still be able to sell. That from Ellen, let's move on to another topic that we can at least start discussing prior to the break. And there is the back and forth here of federal workers who are not working because of the shutdown and federal workers who are working because of the shutdown and their pay. And Senate Democrats on Thursday blocked legislation to pay federal employees who have been working without compensation during the government shutdown, thwarting Republicans' latest effort to weaken their hand in the federal spending fight. The defeat was part of a series of failed partisan votes on the 23rd day of the government shutdown that underscored the depths of the prolonged impasse, with neither Republicans nor Democrats showing any indication that they plan to relent and seek an off-ramp. Democrats say they opposed the GOP measure because it would hand President Trump wide latitude to pick and choose which workers receive compensation while the government is shuttered. Republicans, who offered the bill in part to bolster their argument that Democrats are to blame for any pain that results from the shutdown, contended they were merely catering to their restive progressive base. On a vote of 54 to 45, the measure fell short of the 60 votes it needed to advance. Three Senate Democrats crossed party lines to vote for it, including John Fetterman, John Ossoff, and Raphael Warnock, the last two from Georgia, Fetterman from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so it's just performative, Joe. The reality is, I mean, these are interesting stories to read. At this point, both sides are so entrenched and dug in that it's just theater now. And how we're going to get through the impasse, I'm not sure. It's going to be the longest government shutdown in American history. Remember, shutdowns only started in the Nixon administration, but it's going to be the longest. It's going to be more than the 35 days. I think when I listen to these politicians on both sides of the aisle and the disingenuousness of both of them, when John Thune and Mike Johnson stand up there and say, quote, "We have nothing to negotiate with the Democrats," that's just flat out wrong. I'm sorry, you know, my dad was a Republican. I'm sorry, Republican listeners out there. That's not true, that you don't. A clean bill, a clean piece of legislation doesn't mean you don't have things to negotiate. And Bill can tell us all about the way in which health care can be negotiated in this moment. So that's just disingenuous that we don't have anything to negotiate. On the flip side, Democrats digging in on health care because, again, as David Brooks said this morning, it's a topic that they can run with as opposed to what they really want to run with, which is the fragility of democracy that nobody seems to care about. That too is disingenuous to hold hostage the healthcare subsidies as a vehicle to try to get at Trump. That's disingenuous too. So whether they're going to pay workers or not, or vote in favor of paying workers who are furloughed or not, it's performative, and it is symbolic of the fact that the American political system is broken.
That was Beau Breslin on the Roundtable panel on Friday, October 24th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.